Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film, we also talk about the true story. On this podcast, we touch upon what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. We'll also hear about the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and people who were involved in it. Today, we're going to be talking about American Gangster, directed by Ridley Scott, the director of films such as Blade Runner, Alien, and Gladiator. So this movie was a little bit of a different direction for him. This film is about Harlem gangster Frank Lucas, who flooded the streets of New York with heroin in the 1960s and 70s. It stars Denzel Washington as the titular American gangster, Russell Crowe as narcotics detective Richie Roberts, and a star-studded ensemble that includes Idris Elba, Cuba Gooding Jr., Ruby Dee, Josh Brolin, and Common. Most of the characters are based on real-life people, but not all the names are real. For example, Frank has five brothers, and all their names are changed.
The 2007 film was optioned based off a New York Magazine article titled The Return of Superfly by Mark Jacobson, in which the journalist and gangster walk the streets where he used to roam and reflect on his time as a drug kingpin. The film went through a long pre-production process that included changing directors, main actors, and a lot of back and forth about its budget. Benicio del Toro was originally slated to play Richie, but the film was canceled. Benicio del Toro still walked away with $5 million, so not bad for a movie that he didn't actually film. The role eventually went to Russell Crowe when production started again. It didn't receive a lot of award nominations, which was seen as a snub at the time. Ruby Dee was nominated for Supporting Actress, and the film was nominated for Art Direction, but that's about it. One theory behind these award season snubs is that it was too similar to the previous year's winner, The Departed. Dave, I had not watched this film since I saw it in theaters. And I remembered some iconic moments, specifically Ruby Dee related, actually. But I was surprised by how much I loved watching this film again. What did you think of this viewing of American Gangster?
So I will say that the trailer for American Gangster, I still remember watching it, was so good. Like, I remember being so amped to see this movie in theaters when I saw the trailer back in the day. And then I saw the movie and I was like, it's pretty good. It's pretty good, but like not great. And overall, I enjoyed my viewing experience of American Gangster this time around. But I think the biggest problem that this movie has is, you know, there's this mantra in screenwriting and filmmaking that like, in a script, you shouldn't have characters deliver exposition that feels inorganic. Like, if two brothers are sitting down, you know, you wouldn't say, like, one of them shouldn't say, "Hi, brother, how are you doing, my brother, who I've known for 27 years? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Instead, you want that information to come through organically during the course of events. And I feel like this movie kind of takes that idea to the next level in the sense that the first half of this movie, characters are just saying and doing things without any context whatsoever, in my opinion. Like, it's very confusing what's actually going on in the first 60 to 90 minutes of this film, in my opinion. And I find, as a result, a lot of the actions don't have that much emotional weight for me. But the second half of the film, I think, really, really cooks. When the cat and mouse game starts getting going between Frank Lucas and Richie Roberts, I mean, that is really, really thrilling stuff. And it's great to see both of these actors really doing some top-notch work and encountering each other towards the end. Heat style, like that Heat conversation in the movie Heat in the cafe. The Heat style conversation.
It's hot.
Heat going on.
It's hot. Yeah, I mean, this is the epic reteaming of Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe after the phenomenal film Virtuosity. No, that that actually is kind of an underrated film, despite like how silly some of the special effects look now. But Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington are such incredible stars, and we don't see much work for them these days, actually, from either of them. So I think that was a big reason why I enjoyed revisiting this, is I like just enjoyed watching them do their thing on screen. Denzel especially is just like really going for it in this film. It's funny you mentioned that thing about there not being enough exposition, because I kind of felt, I thought you were going to go in a different direction, because there's the first half of the film involves Denzel Washington calling a bunch of people and being like, "It's me. Who? It's Frank. Who? Your cousin, your brother, your whatever." He says it like five different times on the phone. So I thought it actually, that was one moment where I was like, okay, I see what you're doing there. I don't know. I didn't find the beginning hard to follow. I like the trust that it puts in the audience that they'll sort of catch up. I guess the one critique I would have is the same critique I have of most gangster films, which is that I don't think it needs to be nearly 3 hours. I think these films get a little bogged down in reveling in the like gratuitous violence and gratuitous like sexuality. That's what a gangster film is, right? It's like, come, roll around in the muck with us, have a really fun time watching these like really like terrible people do terrible things. But don't worry, there will be a comeuppance at the end. So, you know, a light comeuppance for Frank Lucas, honestly, given that he like murders several people. But
ultra light. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? I think that there's a middle section where we don't need to see like all of the excess before we get to the fall, if that makes sense. And that's a section that I would, you know, I would feel pretty good about trimming out if we wanted to. But, you know, thinking about it now, I'm like, well, what would this movie be now if Ridley Scott wanted to make it? And in my head, I'm like, this is a limited series.
Yeah, it's a limited series. I agree completely.
It's a limited series. So
it feels to me too long to be a movie and too short for a series. You know what I mean? But I think that, and let me just say about your comments on virtuosity, no one dare badmouth that movie in my presence. RIP Sid 6.7. But also that. I think the problem with the movie is, you know, it's interesting to compare this to movies like Goodfellas, where there is like voiceover, right? And it's oftentimes with these movies based on true stories, you're seeing like snapshots. Here's an event that happened in real life. Here's another event that happened in real life. And in Martin Scorsese movies, voiceover serves as a connective tissue for those things. This movie just does not have that connective tissue, in my opinion. And so I feel like we're lurching from like event to event, particularly earlier on in the movie, without much logic or rhyme or reason. That's just my experience. If you had a different experience, you know, all the best. Anyway, I think we can all agree at least that the latter half of this movie is pretty exciting. What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I love it when a plan comes together. and that's what we see for Richie. So, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Let's get to the movie itself. The film starts with Frank Lucas, played by Denzel Washington, pouring gasoline on a man and then setting him on fire. And then he shoots him as though that's a merciful act. And by the way, this is all out in the open. It's not in a garage or a basement. We immediately get that this is a man who does not screw around. He's a man who will kill you. And here we have crime historian Christian Cipollini and former DEA agent Louis Rice characterize the real-life Frank Lucas. First you'll hear Cipollini, and then you'll hear Rice.
Frank Lucas did develop a reputation. What that reputation was varies from person to person who's heard it, but Frank was quite comfortable in telling the story of how he killed someone, which will certainly give you street credibility. But even outside of murder or general thuggery, Frank Lucas obviously had some street sense to come from the South and set up shop in the epicenter of narcotics dealing in New York City.
Big guy, deep voice, very charismatic. He's the type of guy, if he was sitting here now, he'd tell a joke and you'd walk away and you'd say, oh, he's a nice fellow. And most of the leaders of the organizations are, you know, but good command and control, but he was a guy that you couldn't cross. He was a guy that if you crossed him, he would hurt you.
So then we get the title of the film, American Gangster, based on a true story. And then we get the introduction of Harlem gangster, real-life Harlem gangster, Bumpy Johnson, played by Clarence William III in an uncredited appearance. So Bumpy was a real person. He was played a few other times in other films, including twice by Lawrence Fishburne. He's known as the Robin Hood of Harlem, and we see him here in the film giving out turkeys on Thanksgiving to the people of Harlem. Frank is among them. He's dressed very well, and he is just observing, right? Like, he is sharply observing everything that Bumpy is doing. We don't get a lot of time with Bumpy, but a lot of what happens in the film is about Bumpy's reputation and the dissolution of his territory. Crime historian Christian Cipollini tells us a little bit about the real life Bumpy Johnson.
Bumpy Johnson was a very significant figure in Harlem, in the greater underworld history. Here was a guy from Harlem who started as a bodyguard for the top female bookmaker in Harlem, Madame Stephanie St. Clair. Bumpy Johnson was her bodyguard, a trusted confidant. He had a working relationship with guys like Lucky Luciano. It worked. Everybody wanted to make money. Bumpy rose up through and became an associate, a friend of the Genovese crime family. So by the 1950s, early 60s, Bumpy Johnson was a legend, not just in Harlem, but in greater New York, in the greater organized crime annals of history.
Bumpy and Frank walk down the street and they talk. It's clear that the older man is Frank's mentor. Although, let's be clear, in real life, their lives as gangsters overlapped for only about 5 years. And though Frank claims he was by Bumpy's side when he died, Bumpy's wife says that is not true. Back in the movie, they pass an electronics store. Bumpy is lamenting the fact that these kinds of stores exist, adding middlemen to consumerism and costing people more. This is a not-so-subtle allusion to the fact that the mafia acts as middlemen for all the drugs and illegal substances in New York. But Bumpy gets so upset that he starts speaking strangely, and Frank immediately asks a store associate to call for an ambulance. And we learn later that Bumpy has passed away.
We also meet two cops, Richie Roberts, played by Russell Crowe, and Javier Rivera, played by John Ortiz. Richie's taking night classes to become a prosecutor, but for now, they're on the hunt for some crooked gambling operation, and they're trying to hunt down a bookie. They find his car, open the trunk to find paper bags full of money. So much money. Robert's partner is visibly upset, and they talk about how they can't just turn in the money. Like, the implication here is that everyone in the force is on the take. And if you are virtuous enough to turn over all of this money, it means you might rat out some of your crooked cop brethren. And basically, deciding to turn over the money means you have lost the trust of all the crooked cops, on the beat. And Russell Crowe's character, Richie Roberts, despite all that, decides to do it. They hand over almost $1 million. And as Javier predicted, all the other cops in the station are not happy about it. So this is just letting us know about how many corrupt cops are hanging around the force. Quick question, Dave Chen. You encounter a trunk full of unmarked bills, non-sequential bills, in the trunk of a car somewhere. Do you turn it over? What do you do? What do you do, Dave?
Well, I think this whole part of the movie is really curious because, I mean, it's $1 million that the guy turns in. And we know that because the movie repeats that fact about 67 times, I think, during the course of the runtime, that he turned in $1 million. Joanne, I don't know if you know this. He turned in $1 million.
Technically, it was just like shy of $1 million, but okay.
I think that it's kind of hilarious that this guy is a pariah because not that he went above and beyond in a way that inconvenienced anyone else. Like he didn't be a hero in some crazy way. He just did his job, which is to turn in evidence that he discovered at the scene, and that is enough to turn him into a pariah. I know that's to show how deeply corrupt the police force is, but it is kind of galling if that's the case, that was enough to get you a scarlet letter on you, that you turned in money and did your job.
Well, I think it also has to underscore the virtuosity, the virtuousness of Richie Roberts, and how he is such an anomaly in the force, and that, you know, if it weren't for someone like him existing, this anomalous figure, probably Frank Lucas never would have gotten caught in the first place. You know what I mean? So you needed this exceptional figure. But what I do like is that the movie is like, this guy is not a saint, but in this one avenue of his life, he is a stickler for doing what is right. And here is our
example.
Guess
my question is, was there any amount of money he could have turned in that would have been okay? Like if he kept like 850,000 of it and turned in like 100,000, like then people would have respected him. You know, like what is the bar here? But basically, that's my answer to your question: is whatever that amount is, I probably would have done that. You know, like kept the 850,000, 890,000, whatever it is that would arbitrary amount that would make me respected and also simultaneously rich. That's probably what I would have done.
Okay.
So Speaking of corrupt detectives, a leather-clad detective, Detective Truppo, played by Josh Brolin, brings some drugs from a bust to a deserted plaza. This character's counterpart in real life is a cop Frank only referred to as Babyface. They put all the heroin in a pile to go sell. They keep about a quarter cup to put in the evidence locker, but they're going to divide and sell the rest. We hear a voiceover saying that the cops are just stealing the drugs and then selling it back to the gangsters. The voiceover turns out to be Mafia Man Rossi, played by John Polito, who gives Frank some of that heroin to sell. Frank says it's chaos in the streets now that Bumpy is dead.
You know, one of the big conversations we see about the current state of affairs with the heroin is that both the mafia in the first place and then, you know, and then as it back channels through the cops and back out into the street, the heroin is just getting cut down and down and down, like cut with other agents. So it's not very potent heroin. And this will become like a huge plot point later on when Frank decides to figure out a better way to do things. But before we get there, he meets up with some of his cousins. They mention their relative, Nate, who's in Vietnam. And then Frank shows them a place where they're cutting the heroin. And we're introduced to the woman who will oversee the operation, Red Top, played by Melissa Hill. And then Frank mentions significantly that he never does the stuff himself. At a restaurant, Frank is confronted by a rival gangster named Tango, played by Idris Elba. Tango claims that he's taken over Bumpy's territory and demands 20% of Frank's earnings. Frank is offended and says Tango doesn't know how to extort properly because 20% isn't sustainable.
It's interesting that Idris Elba seems so unsavvy in this movie, especially after he had already played Stringer Bell in The Wire, who is a much smarter gangster than Tango is in this movie. So on TV, we hear about the war in Vietnam and how troops are doing heroin and opium. Meanwhile, Frank is doing his books and hears about how cheap dope is in Vietnam and Thailand, and this gives him an idea. Frank remembers that Nate, his cousin-in-law, is stationed overseas, so he decides to give him a call and work out a deal. The film calls his character Nate, and he's played by Roger Guinevere Smith, but he's actually a man named Leslie Ike Atkinson. He had a business partner named Herman Jackson, and the two of them had tried a heroin operation before Frank got involved. It's interesting that the film doesn't make him into more of a character because the other side of this operation is just as interesting. Here's federal officer Charles Lutz to tell the story.
When the Vietnam War began, for some reason, Herman Jackson went to Bangkok to see what, you know, there were a lot of GIs by then there, and this was, I guess, about 1966. They actually started out in what they called a military payment certificate scam. And if you want me to go into that, I'd be happy to do so. In those days, rather than pay military in Vietnam in U.S. dollars, they paid them in military payment certificates because they knew, or they feared, that the cash, that, you know, would get into the economy and it would end up going north and end up buying weapons to be used against us. So they issued these military payment certificates, and when you left country, you could cash them in for U.S. dollars. So what they would do, and of course you weren't, the locals were not supposed to even have the military payment certificates, but the local merchants in Saigon would accept them for, you know, and guys like Jackson and Atkinson would go over there and buy these MPCs from these local merchants for half of their value, and then cash them in, of course, for full value when they left the country. So, well, what they did is they subverted our military facilities and personnel using military flights and military, like the Army postal system, and military employees who they would, and they did it in a number of ways. One example would be they would get a GI in a card game, fleece him of some money, and then tell him that they could relieve their debt by taking a bag or a box back with them to the States. I had never heard of a case where they had used false bottoms of furniture. Now, there was a case before I got to Bangkok where they were stuffing the heads of leopards with heroin. So it's your imagination. You're limited by your imagination. But I had never heard of false bottom furniture before, no.
So outside the drug game that's happening in this film, we get some personal drama for Richie Roberts, which is that he is going through a divorce and a custody battle. And this is, you know, his ex-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, played by the great Carla Gugino, this is a made-up situation.
Even though this character did, in fact, go through a divorce, it certainly didn't happen in the long, drawn-out way that it was depicted in the film.
But this is something that we have seen these films that we talk about do over and over and over again, where they invent either a marriage or marital drama or divorce or strain or something like that in order to add dimension to their male lead. Dave Chen, what do you think about this tactic, this well-worn tactic?
I mean, it is pretty cliche at this point, you know. I'm surprised movies keep doing it. I think it's just a shortcut. It's just a shortcut to character complexity. It's like, hey, this guy, Richie Roberts, he's so good at his job, but he's not good at everything. Look at how terrible his home life is. You know, like, you want this character to be complex, because if he is Boy Scout, Superman, like, very wholesome, everything, I think people think he'd be less interesting. But the problem is that the only thing less interesting than someone who's like that is somebody who has a very, you know, clearly made up marriage problem in movies such as this one. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, you know, female characters go through this in films as well, where it's like, she's got it all together, but she just can't find a man. You know what I mean? Like, that's the female equivalent. And for guys, it's like, he's got it all together, but oh, he's going through a divorce.
You missed your calling as a trailer voiceover artist, I just want to say.
Maybe that will be my next career. Yeah. Anyway, it does allow for Carla Gugino's character to sort of read him out in a way that I think is pretty effective later on in the film, in terms of like the motivation behind his morality, his rigid moral code at work. What I think is more interesting about this Richie Roberts character is that, yeah, he's a cop and he's sort of like a, you know, like a bro cop. But he's also wants to become a lawyer. He wants to pass the bar exam. So we see him studying. He's got night school. It's this whole thing. And then sort of meanwhile, back on the Frank Lucas side of things, Frank flies to Bangkok. We see American troops overseas. It's interesting to me. I don't think I realized how much of the drug epidemic came sort of directly from the Vietnam War. But that seems to be the implication that the way in which soldiers, you know, became hooked on drugs overseas and took that addiction back home is a big part of how the drug epidemic spread to America. So I think that's an interesting part that this film underlines. But we see Frank go in. There's a bunch of American soldiers around him. This bar that he goes into was actually owned by Jackson and Atkinson. Here's author Ron Chepsik.
Herman Jackson decided to start a bar, which he called Jack's American Star Bar. And this is a really interesting venture because there were four people involved. Herman Jackson, Ike Atkinson, James Smedley, who was another friend of theirs, and a Thai friend named Luchai Rubiwat, who later became their contact with the Golden Triangle and getting the drugs on that sort of thing. Now, this bar became sort of a legend among African-American military personnel in Asia because, you know, every so often the military in Vietnam would go on R&R, right, rest and recreation, and they would go to Thailand. You know, that was a real, real center of entertainment and a good place to relax. And so Jack's American Star Bar became very, very famous. And I met people still today that remember that they were in the military during that period, and they visited that bar. And the bar lasted until about 1973 because the war was winding down.
So there's a back room full of drugs, and Frank finds Nate, and they meet with Chiang Kai-shek's defeated army. Frank asks for 100 kilos of heroin and insists on giving them $100,000 for it, even though $50,000 is sufficient. He wants to make sure they're happy with the deal.
This was something that I was interested in. We see Frank, Denzel as Frank, dressed up as a soldier. And I was reading an interview with the real Frank Lucas where he said that he did dress up as a soldier. Once again, we'll take everything Frank says with a grain of heroin. But like he says that he did dress up as a soldier, and he was like, you should have seen my salute. Like that was like a thing that he did in order to infiltrate this whole operation. Meanwhile, Richie gets a call from his partner, Rivera. Rivera has accidentally killed someone and during what he says is a raid on the projects. Richie calls into dispatch and they say that they don't have anyone around to help. And it's pretty clear that the reason no one is willing to go help them is because they are still pariahs because of the whole $1 million incident. But when Richie gets to the project, there's riot going on around this apartment. Rivera is in there. It's a largely black community here. Richie is a white cop going in there. There is a non-black cop who has shot a young black man in this apartment. And it's like, how are they going to get out of this thing in one piece? Richie kind of puts together that Rivera shot this guy not because he was raiding the projects, but because like of a heroin deal gone bad, that Rivera himself is hooked on heroin. But the main issue right now that Richie has to problem solve is to get them out of there. So he comes up with this like pretty brilliant idea / Weekend at Bernie's scheme to like pretend that the slain drug dealer is alive, put him on a gurney, prop his eyes open, and get him out of there. I really enjoyed the look on the face of the black EMT who's like helping them with this, but also like clearly thinks, does not feel completely great about what's going on here. In the ambulance, we see Rivera and he is completely strung out. He's drooling, actually. And Richie obviously isn't buying his story. He finds the money that Rivera has taken. And Rivera asks, begs Richie to write a report to cover for him. Richie refuses. And Rivera literally throws himself from the ambulance and runs away.
I think the function of this whole sequence is twofold, right? Number one, it's to show that Richie Roberts can still bend the law a little bit if he feels like he's up against a corner and has to, although he kind of swears it off after this whole entire sequence of events. But it's also to show that Roberts is kind of fast on his feet, right? He knows how to think. He can get out of really sticky situations even and keep his cool, which is really important. So, I thought it was an interesting scene.
I'm not sure how much he bends the law here because he's still going to like write his partner up. You know, he's still going to turn him over. But he bends the law in that what he lies that the guy is still alive. Like, I think he's just trying to get everyone out of there, de-escalate the violence, right, and get them all out of there in one piece. Not make sure that his partner gets out of it. You know what I mean? Anyway, another reason that the sequence is here, I think, is it sort of parallels the later raid on the projects that we see. So it's sort of like two instances where Richie has to go in and sort of get out in one piece, was my take on it.
Yeah. So Frank has successfully gotten the drugs into the United States. And while we learn later in the film how they got some of it out of Asia, Federal Officer Charles Lutz offers a couple of other ways he heard Atkinson, who, remember, is Frank Lucas's cousin-in-law, smuggled the heroin out.
Atkinson tried smuggling some heroin himself in duffel bags aboard military aircraft back to the States, was successful in doing that several times. I think he actually did that first and then decided it was a little too risky and started using these other people to do it. They also mailed heroin back through the Army postal system, and they got the money from the proceeds of their heroin back to Bangkok to buy more heroin through the Army postal system, basically mailing it back to themselves. They kind of engineered a way of smuggling. There are these small overnight bags that the GIs called them AWOL bags, absent without leave. You know, it's just a small, like a gym bag type thing made out of leather. And they would sew in a false bottom. Under that false bottom, there'd be about 700 grams of pure heroin.
We get a montage of Frank's distribution process, the woman in the opium den, all naked so they can't steal anything. Joanna Robinson, I have in the notes here that you want to talk about this.
I was noticing this, and I think we saw similar in Goodfellas, right? Like, there's a woman who cuts drugs in her underwear. But in that case, she's just doing it in her own apartment. So it's not even quite the same operation. Anyway, I know that the reason why these women in these gangster slash drug films are forever cutting drugs naked or topless or in their underwear is so that they can't smuggle anything out. I'm also like, how many film directors owe a thanks to the drug lords of the 70s and 80s or whatever for this practice? Because it allows them to just have cocaine and tits like all the way across their films with plausible deniability as to why it's there. You know what I mean?
Oh, because that's how they did it in real life, Joanna.
Right, right. Historically accurate tits. It's fine.
Yeah. I think you're right, Joanna. That definitely is something that is noticeable. And I guess sometimes directors can use reality to their advantage when making something that they think sells better. But in any case, we see people start packing the drugs and we see the route from the dealers in disguises to the users. Frank has clearly gotten rich because he buys an enormous loft in Harlem. I love this kind of montage, Joanna Robinson. I love when you kind of see like how it goes from one location to the other. There's all these things that we don't know about. Like one product goes from, you know, Asia all the way to in these people's hands. And there's all these middle people that you don't even ever really hear about. It's kind of this fascinating behind the scenes process.
Meanwhile, we've seen the last of Rivera. A fellow officer played by pre-Walking Dead Norman Reedus calls in Richie. Rivera has overdosed. The product that Frank is distributing is so pure, so potent, because he went directly to the source, cut out the middleman, right? And he's selling this like undiluted or partially diluted heroin for pretty cheap. And it makes his product irresistible to folks on the street, but also very dangerous. And they're getting all these overdoses as a result of it. And so, you know, because of the heroin epidemic that's starting to rage through in New York and New Jersey, Richie's captain, Lou Toback, played by the great Ted Levine, convinces him to join a narcotics bureau out of New Jersey.
So Frank goes to visit his family in North Carolina. He tries to move them all up to New Jersey, and he immediately puts his family to work as part of his distribution network. I think this part of the movie is a little confusing. He calls up his brother, and played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, and he says, "Hey, it's your brother Frank. Come work for me." And you never really get a sense of like what the relationship was like before. Obviously, it wasn't great because he couldn't recognize his brother on the phone. But I do wish we had gotten a little bit more about like what their history was before he started working for him. Because without that, it gives their interactions fewer stakes, I think. What do you think, Joanna?
I don't know. I thought it was pretty evident that Frank has like left his family in the sticks somewhere and gone to try to make a better life for himself in the city. And he has. And so then he like calls his family to come enjoy the riches. I feel like gangster buys his mom a house is also like a trope that we've seen before. So I don't know. I think it works for me. I get excited because a bunch of actors that we recognize join the cast here. Ruby Dee, the great Ruby Dee, who I think is tremendous in this film as Frank's mom. Ejiofor is great. Common is here. Like we got a lot of faces that we recognize as part of the family. And what we find out later is that Frank has set up this operation to resemble an Italian mafia organization, right? Which where his like number one lieutenants are his literal family. And so, you know, the chance of betrayal is much lower when it's actually your family doing your bidding. So I think that is, you know, this is all has to do with like what Frank has observed from other crime bosses and put into place. Like the whole getting the drugs directly from Asia thing is based off the speech that Bumpy gives. It's just like Frank is so smart and he's observing and he's absorbing and he's implementing and is he a heinous criminal? Yes. Is it somewhat satisfying to watch this man who came from apparently complete poverty and nothing sort of build this life for himself? Yeah, as it is in any gangster film. And this is this sort of like a perverse American dream aspect of what's going on for Frank here. So I don't know. I love this whole part with his family and the infrastructure that he immediately puts in place.
Fair enough.
So the brothers and Frank are at Frank's usual diner, and they're sitting down, and Frank gets distracted because he sees Tango, once again played by Idris Elba, on the street. And we will remember that earlier in the film, Tango demanded 20% off of Frank, and now that's come back to haunt him. Frank immediately leaves the restaurant, demands that Tango put 20% of his take in the jar, and it's this sugar container that he took from the diner. Tango thinks he's kidding, but Frank is not kidding, and he just shoots him straight up in the head in the street in daylight, takes the money out of Tango's jacket, and leaves him 20%. Frank's brothers are a little horrified, but no one says anything. By the way, Frank, once again, we can take everything he says with a grain of salt, but Frank did say that he shot down a rival gangster in the street in the original New York Magazine article and then later denied it. Either way, it's a good way to show just how ruthless Frank can be and just how he feel, how comfortable he feels like he can get away with anything. It's like the Donald Trump, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. He does it broad daylight and then doesn't even leave the scene of the crime, just goes down and finishes his meal. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This is a guy who clearly felt like he could act with impunity, and it's very shocking to see it happen. Also, according to IMDb trivia, anytime Frank Lucas pours an excess amount of sugar while at a restaurant, it's a sign or a code to his bodyguards present throughout the restaurant to keep a close eye on him. This is something he does throughout the film. So I'm not sure if that's true, but you can keep an eye on for it and see what your experience with the Frank and the sugar is. See if it reads as a sign or a code to you. Very possible. Or maybe he just likes sugar a lot. Anyway. In New Jersey, Richie gets introduced to his new team to find out who's selling this heroin and where it's coming from. They're told to only focus on large amounts. Here is Richie Roberts himself talking about their objective.
The government created the Essex County Bureau of Narcotics, among others, in different states. It was headed by a committee, a board, I should say, of the sheriff, the prosecutor, and myself as the director. But we all answered to the U.S. attorney because it was federally funded. And we were told, stop this epidemic. We had other interest as well. There was cocaine in the street. There was all kinds of stuff. So we had enough men to try to address all of the problems. But our main focus was to find out where the heroin was coming from, how it got up into the Jersey area, and to stop it.
The team do a routine stakeout to get a sample of the heroin called Blue Magic, and it's the most potent on the street, but also the cheapest. How is that possible? Former drug enforcement agent Lewis Rice and Richie Roberts give us some insight into what made Blue Magic so special. First, you're going to hear from Rice, and then you're going to hear from Richie Roberts.
Blue Magic, as I understand, was Frank's brand. It was a brand name he gave his heroin to distinguish his heroin from other people's heroin. And then that's a great marketing tool. So when you have a good product and it's out in the street, you want people to ask for it by name. And so he knew he was going to maximize his profits when he had a good product out there and called it Blue Magic. So people would ask, the addicts would ask for, is this Blue Magic?
The serious problem was, if they put 10% in, which they did originally, even 6-7% heroin, people were not used to that. And they started ODing. And that's what actually caused everybody to be excited about it, was that the drug populace were ODing on this brand new product called Blue Magic, which had a greater percentage of heroin, and people couldn't handle it, but everybody wanted it because it gave them a better high.
I thought there was a funny resemblance between Blue Magic and the blue meth that they use in the hit AMC original series Breaking Bad, which is also known for having a blue moniker and being extremely pure, more pure than any of the other drugs on the street. I don't think they explicitly reference American Gangster in Breaking Bad, but this does feel like a clear inspiration. What do you think, Joanna?
Yeah, or at least like the true story of Frank Lucas is a clear inspiration, you know? So in the way of many fictional or real-life gangsters before him feeling themselves, Frank is throwing a huge party at his bar, Smalls. Famous boxer Joe Louis is there, and Miss Puerto Rico, Ava, played by Limari Nadal, is there with him. Frank is absolutely captivated by her, and this character is based on Frank's real-life wife, Julie, who was from Puerto Rico but was never actually Miss Puerto Rico. So one thing that I think is kind of important that happens here is that we see Frank telling Joe Louis that he will take care of a debt for him. And it's not something that Joe Louis ever has to pay back. This is a gift. And this feels like a very bumpy move, he's making smart connections and making people indebted to him with the excess money that he has. But, you know, this is a gangster party after all. So what happens at a gangster party? Fights break out. Frank sees his brother Huey dressed in an outlandish suit and talking to up-and-coming gangster Nicky Barnes, played by Cuba Gooding Jr. He takes Huey to a back room and yells at him for being a bit too obvious, like a little flashy. Also probably for talking to Nicky in the first place. This is some foreshadowing and also something we saw in Goodfellas. You want to look nice, but not suspiciously nice.
I thought the piece of advice he gave about, I think, like the person who is the flashiest or who's the loudest is like the weakest.
Yeah, loudest.
I thought that was interesting. Yeah. Basically, everything I learned about being a successful businessman, I learned from Denzel Washington's version of Frank Lucas in American Gangster, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, at the police office, we learn that Richie has passed the bar exam. Richie's crew of folks puts up pictures of the gangsters, but they want to start over with their leads. He gets $20,000 to buy heroin and watch the exchange, but things go wrong when the NYPD intervenes. Richie confronts the NYPD cops who hassle him, and they make fun of New Jersey, threatening him to stay on his side of the Hudson. Back to Frank's world. After the initial success of the 100 kilos of heroin, Frank is getting in more heroin and distributing more heroin. We get a montage of his brother selling that show that Blue Magic is now across all the boroughs, as well as parts of New Jersey. It might be difficult to imagine how heroin was such a huge problem back in the 1970s, but in this clip, Richie Roberts tries to paint a picture.
You can't overstate how bad the problem was. You really can't. It was horrible. It was just horrible. That was why the government created these narcotic task forces. Heroin, in particular, was out of control. You could go on the streets of Newark. I'm going to limit myself to New Jersey. Newark, Camden, Trenton, wherever there was a inner city and a minority population, you could see addicts, I hate the word junkies, they're sick, they're not criminals, addicts lying on the street corners, sleeping in their cars. You could find needles on the streets. You could find needles in playgrounds. And you could walk down the street and see a pusher. It permeated the entire neighborhoods. The additional problem was that it was spreading out into the suburbs now, which alarmed people who should have been alarmed earlier. But they decided finally we got to stop this. It's hard trying to remember. I get mind pictures, and it's hard for me to believe my own mind pictures because it was that bad.
We also get a nice scene of Frank meeting with mafia man Dominic Catano, played by Armand Desante, and they shoot some clay pigeons together in a villa. Catano tries to convince Frank that his prices are unfair and putting the mafia out of business. Frank tries to hustle them and make a deal to sell them heroin for distribution. They seem to have an agreement, but we're not exactly sure how it's going to go. Here's historian Christian Cipollini to elaborate.
Dating back to the 1920s and 30s, the mafia always had a place in Harlem. And as minorities rose and in their own criminal organizations, the mafia had a considerable relationship with the minority groups because it's all about money. There is no color barrier when it involves money. But what happened later, the minorities saw that they could get narcotics themselves direct, bypassing the mob, who was charging a lot to bring in those narcotics. It became an economic issue and a power issue.
I love that scene with Armando Sante and the Catano family. I love that the film is titled American Gangster. And so I think we have to pay like a really close attention to this idea of like what makes an American gangster, what's uniquely American about this, or how is the American dream tied up in this? We talked about that with Goodfellas as well and early in this episode, but looking at the Catano family and looking at how this mafia don has imported a villa brick by brick from the UK and is like fashioned himself as like a lord basically, and is looking down on Frank and Ava while also having to kowtow to Frank because Frank has amassed so much power for himself. And I really love when they're walking out and Ava's like, you want to do business with them? After they looked at us the way that they did, they look at us like we're the help. And Frank's like, yeah, they work for me now. And I think that whole idea of, because it'll come up again, like how Frank being a black man impacts the story of his rise to power and the unique way in which other crime families are threatened by him.
Yeah. I mean, Frank is constantly underestimated in this movie, right? Like,
yeah.
And the great thing about the scene with Armando Sante's character is that you can tell Armando Sante hates the position he's in. He's seething with rage. Right, there's all this subtext between the two of them of like, I need your help, but I don't want to need your help, but I need your help anyway. Please help me. And by the way, P.S. maybe think about raising your prices. You know, like I love that there's a lot that's unsaid between these characters, and you kind of have to read into what's going on the surface as well as what's going on underneath.
So Frank proposes to you, Ava, and he got her a very flashy, sparkly ring. She got him something perhaps a little flashier, a giant chinchilla coat, which in and of itself is quite the gift. But then it has a hat to match. So, this is based on a real life. I've seen a photo of the real Frank Lucas wearing this ensemble. So this actually happened. He did wear the hat and the coat out in public. And, you know, this sort of clashes with Frank's earlier speech about, like, let's not be too flashy, let's not stand out. So in this grand romantic gesture to his beloved new fiance, Frank wears this ridiculous coat to the big fight, the fight of the century that's happening in New York City. He's there. He's got amazing seats. He's cozying up to Joe Louis for this fight, which is Muhammad Ali versus Joe Frazier. What did you make of the list of celebrities they said were going to be at the fight in this film? It's pretty amazing. Diane Keaton and Woody Allen stood out to me as like, oh, Diane and Woody were at the fight of the century. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's amazing. And it also just shows you, like, this was a guy who rose from really the bottom rung to become hobnobbing with the upper echelon of society, right? Like, that's really what this scene and a few others in this movie helped to illustrate.
Yeah. So, like, in real life, Frank has talked about whether or not this coat, this chinchilla coat, is the thing that got him on the radar with the police. There's some question about that. Like, I think he was definitely already a person of interest to the police. But the fact that he was there in that coat, hobnobbing with, quite famous and influential people, and had incredible seats, better seats than a mafia don, in the film at least, definitely put him on the radar for Richie, who has shown up sort of disguised as a photographer to see what he can see. I really like this move from Richie. This is a very, like, once again, Richie is a smart investigator move, right? And, his colleagues are like, whatever, it's a fight. He's like, no, it's politics, and I'm going to go see who's talking to whom at this fight. It's a very, very smart bit of police work here. So Richie sees Frank here in the film, but the two don't actually interact. But this is, we see it, it's all the wheels are starting to turn to move these two men into each other's orbit in the context of the film. And that is the end of part one.
Yeah, and that's what we have to look forward to in part two, Richie and Frank finally meeting. And while it's not all bad for the gangster, it's very bad for the NYPD and for the mafia. So stay tuned for that on next week's episode of Truth vs. Hollywood. Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production. It's hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It's produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. You can find me over at Culturally Relevant at culturallyrelevantshow.com. It's a podcast where I interview filmmakers and artists every week. And also the Slash Filmcast at slashfilmcast.com, where I talk about movies on a weekly basis.
You can find me rewatching the 2004 TV show Lost week by week on the Storm Podcast at stormpodcast.com. Also, I will be watching some fun TV shows over on Vanity Fair's Still Watching Podcast.
Feel free to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows, and leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. It would help this podcast to stand out amidst the crowd. Thanks for listening. Until next time, stay truthful.